You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a message from CyberBit. Mastering cybersecurity is like mastering a sport. You build muscle memory through rigorous practice, then you train as a team to foster cohesion while operating under pressure. Like athletes, cybersecurity professionals thrive on hands-on simulation. But traditional courses, certifications, and open-source labs won't build you a winning team. You need CyberBit. CyberBit offers a hyper-realistic simulation environment for your SOC, IR, and C-suite to refine your skills, all using the market-leading SIEMs, EDRs, firewalls, and WAFs they use every day. CyberBit is offering CyberWire listeners a free live fire exercise. Sign up your team now at cyberbit.com/cyberwire.
DHS tells the U.S. executive branch to stop using Kaspersky security software. Crumtech finds Elasticsearch servers hosting point-of-sale malware. Blueborn bugs buzz billions of boxes. Equifax says that its breach was accomplished via the Apache Struts flaw patched in April. Industry notes include both venture funding and acquisition news. We take a quick look back at the Billington Cybersecurity Summit and in a scene soon to be ripped from the headlines. Counselor, watch yourself. I may not hold you in contempt, but if you continue, I'll cycle power and reboot you. I'm Dave Bittner in Baltimore with your CyberWire summary for Thursday, September 14th, 2017. Yesterday, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security issued binding Operational Directive 17-01, directing that all U.S. government executive branch agencies stop using Kaspersky security software within 90 days. Acting Homeland Security Secretary Elaine Duke issued the order, which, as the DHS public statement says, calls on departments and agencies to identify any use or presence of Kaspersky products on their information systems in the next 30 days, to develop detailed plans to remove and discontinue present and future use of the products in the next 60 days, and at 90 days from the date of this directive, unless directed otherwise by DHS based on new information, to begin to implement the agency plans to discontinue use and remove the products from information systems. The directive is based on an assessment of risk, and DHS has not presented evidence publicly of any Kaspersky wrongdoing. It has, however, explained the risk as follows. Quote, Kaspersky antivirus products and solutions provide broad access to files and elevated privileges on the computers on which the software is installed, which can be exploited by malicious cyber actors to compromise those information systems. The department is concerned about the ties between certain Kaspersky officials and Russian intelligence and other government agencies, and requirements under Russian law that allow Russian intelligence agencies to request or compel assistance from Kaspersky and to intercept communications transiting Russian networks. The risk that the Russian government, whether acting on its own or in collaboration with Kaspersky, could capitalize on access provided by Kaspersky products to compromise federal information and information systems directly implicates U.S. national security. End quote. As White House Cybersecurity Director Robert Joyce commented yesterday at the Billington Cybersecurity Summit, the assessment of risk is based on requirements in Russian law that companies cooperate with the FSB intelligence agency. Joyce agreed with the directive. Quote, it was a risk-based decision and the right call. It's unacceptable that a company could move data to Russia where law requires it to cooperate with the FSB. End quote. The binding operational directive is perhaps not so final as it might appear. DHS says, at the end of its statement, that it's providing Kaspersky with the opportunity to submit a written response addressing or mitigating security concerns. Anyone else who has an interest in the matter will also be afforded the opportunity to comment. Watch the Federal Register for notices affecting binding operational directive 17-01. We've got an interesting cybersecurity story from Brazil to share today. Renato Marinho is chief research officer at Morphus Labs. A friend of his called about an interesting incident involving some social engineering. Someone with a good bit of specific knowledge about the friend's company called an employee in their finance department and told them that he was from their bank and that unless they updated their system with some specific software, they would lose access to their online banking system, which of course was important for their day-to-day operations. Mr. Mourinho picks up the story from there.
The call was recorded. Fortunately, the employee didn't follow the instructions and ended the call. He suspected that it was a kind of scam and talked to the person in charge of information security inside of the company, that was my friend. When he sent me the audio recording of that call, I became very impressed about how it was done. It was done in a very professional way. It seems that the guy, the attacker, was calling from a real call center because of the background noise. I received the URL that the guy was enticing the victim to access. And that was the moment that I perceived that the URL was pointing to the Google Chrome App Store. I knew that it was a very different way of attack and started to analyze the extension code.
And so what did you find?
When I started to analyze the source code, it was not difficult to reverse engineer it because it was written in JavaScript. So the first thing I noticed that the extension was waiting for the user to access a specific banking URL. Was waiting for the user to type the credentials at the website. It was prepared to capture the credentials and send to a remote server. The server, of course, was an attacker host. So it was receiving the credentials the user was typing.
What was the name of the Chrome extension? What was it disguising itself as?
Yes, the name is very strange. It's Interface Online. It's nothing to see about the banking name. It was also strange that there was no screenshot. Another interesting point is that the Chrome extension virus total hate was zero. It's interesting to note that it was not identified by the antivirus solutions. It was installed by at least 30 victims.
So is the extension still on the Google Chrome store? Has it been pulled?
No, it isn't online anymore. After we reported to Google about the incident, they removed the extension from the App Store. After one day, we noticed that the extension came back with another name. We reported Google again, and they removed the extension for the second time.
So what is your advice for organizations looking to protect themselves against this sort of thing?
I think that is very difficult for a regular employee to detect this kind of attack because we are talking about an extension hosted at a Google Chrome official store. And we usually put much trust into these big companies. But for example, user may suspect about the number of downloads of that extension, the extension name. There was no screenshots or information about the banking itself into the extension. The extension asked for much permissions inside of the browser. It asked to read and to write any field inside any website. I think that in that point, Google could improve the security when an extension asks for read some field, including sensitive information like passwords. The user should be alerted or could be asked for additional permission to do that.
That's Renato Mourinho from Morphus Labs. Chromtech Security says it's found more than 4,000 Elasticsearch servers hosting files related to Alina POS and Jack POS, both strains of point-of-sale malware. Both of the affected Elasticsearch servers are to be found in Amazon Web Services. Alina POS and Jack POS use the servers to collect, encrypt, and transfer credit card information scraped from point-of-sale terminals or infected Windows machines. The Blueborn vulnerability in Bluetooth, whose discovery Armis Lab announced Tuesday, may have been addressed by both Microsoft and Google in their most recent patches, but the estimated rates of susceptibility to attack through this vector are astonishingly high.
More than 5 billion devices worldwide are thought to be vulnerable. As usual, patching them all will amount to another labor of Hercules. Until you're sure you're patched and up to date, experts are advising people turn off Bluetooth when it's not in use. Equifax has cleared up the confusion over which vulnerability attackers used in their massive theft of the credit bureau's data. It was the earlier Apache Struts vulnerability, CVE-2017-5638, which was patched in April, some 2 months before Equifax sustained its attack. The credit bureau had earlier suggested that it was the victim of an attack that used either a much more recently patched Apache Struts vulnerability or some hitherto unknown zero-day. But no, it's the old bug after all. There's some piling on. Okay, a lot of piling on. Rival credit bureau Experian complains that Equifax's clumsy disclosures have impeded Experian's ability to ensure the security of the data it holds. Tom's Guide reports that other credit bureau systems in India may have been vulnerable to the same Apache Struts bug that affected Equifax, although there are no reports of other data breaches similar to those Equifax sustained. And there's been unseemly schadenfreude over Equifax's choice of passwords for admin accounts in its Argentinian operations. Username admin, password admin, which would seem easy enough to remember. In industry news, AppGuard announces that it's closed a $30 million round of Series B funding. Silent Circle is buying Casala, and Talis announced its purchase of Guavas. Brocade's acquisition by Broadcom is proving rocky for employees, reports indicate, with several executives departing early over uncertainties as to when the deal will actually close. The annual Billington Cybersecurity Summit was held in Washington, and the industry and government leaders who spoke agreed that proliferation of the Internet of Things, designed for the most part with inadequate attention to security, has vastly increased the attack surface U.S. critical infrastructure presents to adversaries. There was a great deal of clarity on the part of the Director of National Intelligence and others as to who those adversaries in cyberspace are. Russia, front and center, of course, and out to erode public trust. China, interested mostly in economic advantage. Iran, a dangerous regional junior version of Russia. North Korea, determined to secure survival of Mr. Kim by whatever means it deems necessary. And violent extremist groups, a euphemism for ISIS and competing jihadist organizations. These last have negligible hacking capability, at least so far, but they've excelled at information operations. We have further accounts of the summit on our website, with more coming. And to return to the Equifax breach, the U.S. Federal Trade Commission has opened an investigation into the incident, and the U.S. Senate is making noises about conducting its own inquiries. Even the robots are piling on. Most legal practice has yet to be automated, but there's an undercurrent of suspicion that the profession may be as ripe for disruption by robots as the long-haul trucking industry seems to be. Do Not Pay, a robo-lawyer best known for helping drivers appeal and beat parking tickets, has apparently joined the plaintiff's bar. Do Not Pay will provide aggrieved victims of the breach with the documents they need to sue Equifax in small claims court. You can apparently do this for damages of up to $25,000. And if you don't like how your lawyer's dealing with you, just reboot.
Every day, your IAM tech debt grows. Your multi-generational services struggle to work together. Building an identity fabric can fix this. It makes all your identity tooling stronger and allows you to connect any app to any service you want to use. With zero coding, zero maintenance, and zero app downtime. Strata's identity orchestration platform separates the identity logic from your applications, so you can optimize existing IAM tools and manage them in a single control plane. Now, every vendor, standard, and architecture work together. In short, building your identity fabric means you can secure your non-standard apps, keep your complex access policies, retire outdated IDPs, and modernize in record time. So build your fabric with Strata Identity and get rid of tech debt for good. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your identity priorities, and receive a pair of AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations over 5,000 employees. Connect today at strata.io/cyberwire. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
Joining me once again is Johannes Ulrich. He's from the SANS Technology Institute and also the ISC Stormcast podcast. Johannes, so welcome back. You wanted to give us an update today on the Mirai botnet. What do we need to know?
Yeah, the Mirai botnet really sort of started to emerge about a year ago. That's when we saw the first sort of wave of attacks that used this magic password that these security camera DVRs are vulnerable for. Now, what we really see is that it hasn't really let up. There is still probably 100,000 or more infected systems out there that are constantly scanning the internet. I connected one of these DVRs to my standard small business cable modem connection, and within 2 minutes, repeatedly, it got infected with various versions of this malware. So essentially, as an end user, you have not even a chance to sort of download a patch or apply security settings if you're connecting a system like this to an open internet connection these days.
So with these cameras, is there any way of using them safely, or is it better just to avoid them altogether?
The best thing is to avoid them altogether. There is no simple patch for them. Some of them supposedly have firmware updates, but they're very difficult to find and to apply. You may be able to put them behind a firewall, but then again, you're losing some of the functionality because now you no longer are able to remote access your security footage, which is one of the features people install them for.
And is there a master database where if you're in the market for a security camera, you can check to make sure it's not vulnerable to this?
That's a real tricky part. There are some databases like this, but the problem is that these cameras or also these DVRs these cameras connect to, they are being sold under a large number of different brand names. There were only 3-4 different manufacturers, but they're being sold under dozens of different brand names. So for the end user, it's very difficult to figure out if they're receiving a vulnerable model or not.
All right. Good information as always. Johannes Ulrich, thanks for joining us.
Are lengthy security reviews pulling attention away from your security program? With the largest network of trust centers, Vanta can help you streamline security reviews to win customer trust, save time, and close deals fast. Proactively demonstrate security by showcasing key resources like your SOC 2 or ISO 27001 and provide real-time evidence for passing controls. And when a security questionnaire is required, Vanta takes the first pass for you. Visit vanta.com/cyber to take a self-serve tour. That's vanta.com/cyber.
And that's the CyberWire. We are proudly produced in Maryland by our talented team of editors and producers. I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening.